The funeral of Northern Ireland's former Deputy First Minister, Seamus Mallon, will take place later today in County Armagh. Mr Mallon died, aged 83, on Friday. As Deputy Leader of the SDLP from 1979 to 2001, Seamus Mallon was described as one of the architects of the peace process, even though he told BBC Northern Ireland in an interview last year that given another chance, he would do some things differently.
There are many things I would do differently. Things that I would still do. But I suppose with the benefit of hindsight, I would be able to do them. Maybe in a way which was less hurtful to some people. Would I do other things differently? Yes, I believe I would. I believe the way in which people had to live for so long and violence. As a result of violence, I think there are things we all could and should have done to end that.
Earlier I spoke to the SDLP leader, Colm Eastwood.
Look, we're just devastated, to be honest, Stephen, but over the last few days we've had a great opportunity to reflect on everything that he did and all of the people whose lives he changed. There's just no legacy like being able to bring peace to a country. You just have to think about it. I mean, Seamus was a very important part of that generation that ended the Anglo-Irish conflict. That couldn't be done for centuries, and it has been done.
And what part did he play?
Well, I mean, he would always say, and John would have agreed, I think, John would have been the visionary, but Seamus was the negotiator. Seamus was the person who put the building blocks in place to make sure that there was an agreement. But he was also somebody, throughout all the very, very difficult years, who was able, you know, living in Market Hill, a very unionist area, able to stand up against injustice. Whether that injustice came from the IRA or the UDR, he was prepared to stand up and say it at great personal cost, you know, living there with his family, but also unafraid of anybody, not afraid of a paramilitary organisation, not afraid of the REC, not afraid of anybody who was out to destroy relationships within our communities. And I think that is his legacy. But he was also somebody who, whilst we always talk about him being straight-talking and tough and all those things, and he was all those things, he was also a soft man behind it, and an emotional man, and a very supportive man, somebody who would be very interested in what you were doing and always ask about people and all that. So he was a great man, and those of us who knew him well will miss him greatly, and I think the country will miss him as well.
How frustrated did he get with the collapse of the Assembly?
He was very frustrated. I think he was frustrated generally at the pace of change. He was frustrated that the great opportunity that his generation had given us hasn't been fully utilised. I don't think anybody in 1998, when they were negotiating the Good Friday Agreement, they finally signed it. And then afterwards, they dealt with all the tough issues, like policing, and he made an immense contribution to that, like prisoner release, like all of these things that we would still, more than 20 years later, be grappling with stability. That wasn't the plan, you know, and that you know, annoy him greatly. So I think he was delighted then to see the Assembly back up and running again. He was particularly delighted, to be honest, to see the SDLP doing well in the Westminster election, because he really cared about the party. And it was great that Nicola and Claire and myself were able to see him a couple of weeks ago, and it just gave him a real boost.
I remember, Colm, we were trying to get him on to a Nolan show, and we were talking to him on the phone, and he said, "Even my dog doesn't like the Nolan show."
Yeah, Jesse wasn't a fan. No, the great thing about Jim is, I mean, he wouldn't go behind your back, you know.
Yeah.
He would tend to do your face. I mean, he would always, he would keep you right, but he would tell you when you weren't right. And that, I found his counsel so valuable. Even when we disagreed, he wasn't going to sugarcoat it. And that's, I could say, right up until the very, very end, he would say exactly what he felt. But it wasn't out of any desire to knock you off your perch. It was genuinely to try to be honest with you. And I think that's, I mean, somebody asked me over the weekend in another interview, how did he manage, you know, how did he walk that tightrope between criticising the RUC one day and going to their funerals the next? He said he didn't walk a tightrope, he just told the truth. He did what he said what he believed to be the truth, and that was how he lived his life. And I think it stood him in good stead, and I think it actually gained him respect from right across the community, because when you dealt with Seamus, you knew what you were dealing with.
What do you make, just finally, Colin, while you're with us this morning, Arlene Foster deciding to participate in RTE's Late Late Show on Brexit night as a bridge-building gesture to the Republic, she says?
Well, I mean, you know what I think about Brexit and what I think about the DUP's position on Brexit, but I think it's a good thing if Arlene was going. I don't know why it should be such a big deal, to be honest. It's a political, or it's a TV interview. It's a major show in Dublin, and it should be par for the course that politicians from here would take part. I think it's important that viewers in Dublin get to see Arlene, and also that Arlene gets to interact with people in Dublin as well. There really shouldn't be a controversy about this. I think it's positive, and we need more of it.
And the more important thing, of course, in Northern Ireland is this deal where people have been promised a whole category list of things that are going to be delivered on the ground. And you were one of those leaders that signed up to the deal without any numbers in it, without any financial commitments in it. Do you think in the end that was a mistake?
Well, I think the bottom line is this, and this is maybe the onset thing. The DUP and Sinn Féin were going to go back into government no matter what, because they had no choice, because the people made it very, very clear that they had no choice in the elections in Westminster.
You can't blame them for an action. You're a party in your own right. Why did you sign up to an agreement without any financial numbers in it?
I'm not blaming them for it, but if you actually look at some of the key asks that we had, they were then later announced by the Secretary of State and as ring-fenced funding. So I think we did quite well in terms of that. There are other things in there that we want to see delivered that haven't been ring-fenced, and that's now over to this executive to decide whether or not they're prepared to invest in things like childcare, expanding McGee University beyond what's already been ring-fenced, building enough social houses so people have got a roof over their head.
And are you like Sinn Féin? Are you ruling out tuition fees and water rates?
Look, we don't think either of those policies are good ideas. But what I also think is not a very good start to an executive is politicians from different parties who are supposed to be in an executive speaking to each other over the media. I think the most important thing actually is that the people who are in the executive should be around the executive table talking about policy issues.
Yeah.
They shouldn't be doing it over the airways, and I don't want to contribute to that. Our position on those issues have been well aired, but we do need to find a way. We do have a crazy economic policy in Northern Ireland where we have a cap on the number of students that we educate here. Now, we do pay for students to go to England. It is economic madness to not expand university provision here. We will never be able to reach our economic potential if we don't expand university.
But it's economic madness.
We don't have a discussion about how we do that, but let's not do it over the...
But it's economic madness, surely, Colm, for a leader of a political party like yours to understand that we need to raise revenue from somewhere. It ain't coming from the British government. You lot didn't nail it when you could have done, or you could have had a lot more leverage to try to achieve it. And now you're categorically ruling out tuition fees, which are paid across...
I haven't categorically ruled out anything. What I have said...
So you haven't categorically ruled out water rates or tuition fees?
Well, I don't want to see water rates. I don't support water rates, and we won't support water rates.
But hard choices need to be made in Northern Ireland, so you are categorically ruling it out.
Very hard to answer a question if you keep talking over my answers. What I'm telling you is this. We already pay for water through our rates. We need to look at how we fund higher education. I think it should be an economic and political priority coming from the government. And also, the idea, though, that Northern Ireland is supposed to fund itself is mad. When was that ever the case? There's parts of not the north of England, there's parts of Scotland, there's parts of Wales, and there's parts of the Republic of Ireland that you just can't siphon off and say, right, you now have to fund yourself. That's not how it works. That's not how an economy works. We do need to make hard decisions. I do think there will be more money coming in the budget, and I've been assured of that. But let's do it in a way where we sit down around the table and discuss them. I don't think it's healthy.
Being assured of that by Julian Smith, the Secretary of State, Paul?
Sorry?
Assured that more money's coming in the budget by the Secretary of State?
Yes, I have been, yeah.
How much?
Well, I haven't got a figure, and I don't think he has a figure either, because the budget is set by the Chancellor.
Well, then it means nothing.
But there will be, it is very obvious, actually, when you look at the Tory party's manifesto, there will be Barnett consequentials coming from big spend, largely around the north of England. So let's see what happens there. That's an ongoing discussion. But the bottom line is...
We would have got that money anyway. You didn't leverage the... Julian Smith was desperate to get this deal over the line. The Barnett consequential money was coming anyway. So have we not sold ourselves short in terms of a hard, brutal negotiation?
Well, you might want to ask the people who have been campaigning for a medical school for McGee, which has now been ring-fenced, earmarked and ring-fenced, and that funding is secure, who leveraged that, because I know who did it, and it was us who did it in those negotiations. We wanted a whole lot more. There's a whole lot written into those into that paper. Now we have to deliver it. But that's the job of governments. Is anybody seriously saying that we should have held out, not gone into government, when we had 3 years of no government, 3 years of nothing happening, and an election where people told us, screamed at us to get back to work, that we should hang out and wait longer? That's just not the political reality. Political reality was people wanted government back up and running. We've been crying out for it for 3 years. What we wanted to do was maximise the negotiations around the programme for government. When very few others were actually talking about anything regarding the programme for government, we were putting things on paper. Now the reality is we now have a government. We need to sit down, talk through their priorities, make sure that they're properly funded, but get on with the job. That's what people want us to do.
Colm Eastwood, thank you very much indeed. So that's the leader of the SLP, 03030805555 is the number to call this morning. Quite a lot in that this morning. Why they went back in to government without the financial commitment in that deal, how they see the future. And obviously, Colm came on at the very top of the show to pay tribute to the former Deputy First Minister, Seamus Mallon, whose funeral will take place later today in County Armagh. Tom Kelly worked with Seamus Mallon. Good morning to you, Tom.
Good morning, Stephen.
How will you remember him?
Well, I mean, I think I've described it as working with him was like trying to stand up on a roller coaster, because there was never 2 days the same when you worked with Seamus. And he was a man of great sort of inspiration, but also spontaneity. He used to like a flutter on the horses, and, you know, if a wind came in, he would get a couple of bottles of champagne into the office and close the office up and have a bit of an impromptu party. And it was just absolutely amazing. And at one stage, we had an intern, a young American intern, working with us. He was sweeping out bird droppings in the loft, and he was asked to join in. Later on, that young fellow became the staff secretary to President Clinton and actually welcomed Mallon to the White House. So, and he reminded him of the job, you know, he was given. But he was an incredible person. You were just naturally drawn to him. And as Colm said, look, or Claire Hannah, I think, actually, had said, he was very grumpy as well, you know. And, I mean, he had a glare. And you stayed well out of the way of that if he was in bad form. But overall, I mean, I had lunch with him a few months ago in October. And, you know, he wasn't a man to reminisce much about the past in many ways. Like, I mean, I had lunch with him in October, and he was basically talking about the stagnation at Stormont and giving off about why the party had lost an active negotiation.
What was he saying?
His attitude was that, you know, why can they not sit around the table and thrash it out? He said there's nothing insurmountable that's keeping them apart for the past 3 years. And he was right, because look how quickly they got back in together again. So he was very critical of that. He was very critical about the breakdown of British politics at Westminster, because he loved Westminster. He was regarded as one of the finest speakers in Westminster. And he lamented the whole sort of deterioration in terms of the chamber and the aggravation and the polarisation in politics. And that's the way he was talking. The man was 83 and he was talking about the future.
He said he was drawn into the civil rights movement and into politics because of the discrimination he witnessed in his hometown, Tom. The family, I'm quoting him here, he said, the family of one of my pupils was trying to get out of a horribly dilapidated home, an India council house. At that time, councillors had the power of allocation. That family was actually turned down by a unionist councillor. It's quite unbelievable when you read this, who said the following: no Catholic pig and his litter will ever get a home in Market Hill while I am here.
I know. It's language that, you know, it's something that you'd have heard of in South Africa in the 60s. It's just amazing to hear that kind of language. But remember, too, that Seamus regarded Market Hill as his home, and the people of Market Hill were his neighbours, no matter what tradition they came from. And, you know, he was in the council chamber the night that Charlie Armstrong was shot outside Armagh Council. You know, he was driving through Market Hill when a policeman he knew was shot. And, you know, Seamus held his hand under a cattle truck while he died and heard his last words, basically. You know, but people weren't listening in the 80s. I mean, I know a lot of people say, you know, I was reading stuff on social media which was negative. And people were saying, oh, Seamus Mallon didn't condemn OUC murders or UDR murders. They weren't listening. I wrote those statements. Seamus Mallon went to the houses of anyone who was killed in his constituency. But he also was the justice spokesperson. And he didn't believe that the state had the right to overreach itself and to kill people unlawfully. So therefore, he was also that voice as well. And it just was a time when you were deafened out. But I seriously believe that people like Seamus Mallon, Eddie McGrady, John Hume, they stopped Northern Ireland falling into an abyss in the 1970s and the 1980s and early 90s.
And finally, Tom, how will you remember Seamus Mallon?
A bit like a second dad. You know, you could love him to death and he's also very infuriating. I'll miss going to him and getting that curmudgeonly advice. And as Colm Eastwood said, you know, he would criticise you, but he never fell out with you. You know, and that was a great thing. And I think that's one of the things we need to learn. Northern Ireland, we can have differences. It doesn't necessarily mean that we're enemies or that we have to hate each other.
Tom, thanks very much indeed. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.